Hello, good evening, and welcome to this, the second episode of the fifth season of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Tuesday, the 13th of March, 2012, and in this episode, we are going to discuss this week's hot topic and interview Ubuntu community manager, John O'Bacon. We will, of course, cover the latest news, events, a bit about Ubuntu, and go over your feedback. All of it. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website or in the IRC channel, /ubuntu-uk-podcast on the Freenode network. I'm Tony, and with me this week are Laura, Mark, and Alan. It's a full house, everybody.
Hi!
Laura's back.
Hiya!
Good. Excellent. Right, are we all together now?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Mark.
Contrary to popular belief.
Okay.
Hello and welcome to the Ubuntu UK podcast.
Yeah. It's a bit late now.
Oh, sorry.
And you forgot to press the magic button as well. So what have you been doing the last couple of weeks, Mark?
I've been playing, talked at Ogcamp and probably sometime in the last season about my home cloud server thing. I've been playing with that and adding some more things to it. I've put my own OpenID authentication thing on there.
Okay.
So now rather than having... say Google is my OpenID provider, I have my own one.
You are your own OpenID provider. Yeah. This is what's wrong with OpenID. Everyone wants to be a provider.
Everybody wants to.
And so all the people in your house have OpenIDs?
Let's say 50% of the people in my house have OpenIDs.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I've been finally getting round to working out how to have it properly SSL'd with a real SSL certificate, not a self-signed one, on my dynamic DNS host name.
You're going to pay for one? Or are you gonna...
No, I've got a free one, which is on one of the subdomains of my real domain, which points at the dynamic DNS
name. Sounds like an awful lot of hard work.
For you.
Well, I'm only doing it for myself, so...
That's fair enough, yeah. Cool. Alan.
Hello.
How are you?
Tickety-boo.
Good, good. What have you been up to?
I've upgraded my mum's computer to 1204.
Okay.
And the kids' netbooks as well.
Isn't that a bit premature?
Yeah, it's not out yet. I wouldn't recommend anyone else does this, but I thought it'd be fun, you know.
How did it go?
Yeah, all right. Mum's machine is an Acer Aspire Revo. That's her desktop PC.
Okay.
And she was running 1004, so she still had the buttons on the right, because I didn't move them to the left at the time. And she had the old GNOME two-panel thing. And yeah. I thought, I know, I'll upgrade her.
Really confuse her.
I spent the day working from her house, and I thought, well, I'm here, I'll just, you know, press the button and upgrade it. And, well, I've not heard anything back since.
Yeah, because she can't get online anymore.
Funny man. Yeah, no, it seems to work all right. And she's, yeah. She's all right. I mean, she won't be filing bugs and stuff, I wouldn't have thought, right now. She's like tends to sit in a web browser. And the kids have... I've upgraded the kids' netbooks, those little EPCs, and they seem to be working okay. They're using them more than ever now.
Okay, that's good.
But they were on 1104, so they already had Unity. Mm. So yeah, all good.
Laura, what about you?
I went to my first ever hackathon, the London Green Hackathon. And
how was that?
It was very interesting. It was... organised in London to get people together to do hacks relating to sustainability. And there were some very interesting hacks. I didn't actually hack anything. I think our group makeup was to develop a light.
Right.
Were you given things to do?
No, we had to come up with things to do. So we came up with lots of things to do, but we didn't have anywhere to actually
didn't have
do
the resources
them.
To yeah. do. Oh.
And by the time we did come up with something, the developers in our group had wandered off and started hacking a Kindle instead.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, no, it was lots of fun, though, actually. And I got some free USB rechargeable battery things. You know, like the rechargeable batteries you plug into a USB port.
All right. Do they actually work?
Not yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's no Linux support for them.
I shouldn't laugh.
That's not why.
Yeah, okay. Of course.
So, Tony, what have you been up to?
I had the fun task of trying to retune my Myth TV box. They turned the analog channels off on the Roe Ridge transmitter on the Isle of Wight.
We've switched to digital, haven't we now?
Yes, indeed. So everybody in the southeast of England, just about, or this part of the country anyway, had to retune their TVs. The TV was easy. The Myth box was less easy and involved some SQL.
I thought Myth was supposed to be easy these days.
And yeah. We don't have.
We've lost channel four anymore. At some point. There's a cat trying to eat your headphone lead. So that was quite a challenge. I remember years ago, John O'Bacon saying that.
Yeah. He's actually eating my headphone cable. Get off!
He's fighting Poppy.
Get off!
Oh dear. He gets an electric shock.
Talk amongst yourselves, listeners.
He's proper chewing it.
Saying that, you know, you did need a degree in physics to install Myth TV, and that's possibly still the case. Fortunately, I have got a degree in physics, but it's still quite a lot of hard work. Right, okay. One of us is going to need to tackle that cat. Quite soon.
I want to take a picture.
Yeah, okay. I also signed up to Pinterest.
Oh, that thing with pictures and stuff.
Yeah, I got a Mr. Ben on IRC was trying to give me a shoeing for it. I'm not quite sure why. I don't know quite was controversial.
I have no idea what the site does or is.
It allows you to collect images, which for somebody who's into photography is quite a good thing. But
quite appropriate, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. Right. Four seasons, this hasn't happened.
With the number of cables stretched across the studio.
It's not a mains cable, listeners. We're all right.
Yes.
Right. Should we get on with the show?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
It's time for our hot topic.
Yeah, we couldn't get clearance of using the Alan Partridge version of that.
Indeed, yet. Hot topic. So, this week the subject is Raspberry Pi is not the saviour of computer science, it's just the flavour of the month. You see there's a little pun there. Flavour of the month.
Yeah.
Tumbleweed.
As last time, we're going to have somebody supporting that statement, and that's going to be Laura, and we have somebody who is going to denigrate their statement, and that is Mark. And Alan is going to be monitoring the comments on Twitter and on the IRC channel and the web chat and stuff. So if you have comments, please do send them in, and we will be able to sort of incorporate them into the discussion a little bit later on in the segment. But with a fresh mouthful of water... Laura, would you like to kick your discussion off by... starting your debate. Over to you.
So, Raspberry Pi is, according to Linux Format, the $25 Linux box that's going to revolutionise programming. It's going to fix the problem of getting children into computing, and it's going to increase the number of students doing computing degrees and going on to do computing jobs. My main problem with such claims starts from the premise that it's a technology problem. Raspberry Pi's initial release is for enthusiasts who can then go away and write software and learning materials around it before it's released to schools. This seemed backwards to me. One of the biggest complaints we've heard is that schools focus on teaching office IT skills instead of proper computing and programming skills. The solution to that might be to train teachers to teach proper computing skills, fix school policies that obstruct teachers teaching such material, and if it's lacking, write new teaching and learning materials. There seems to be some kind of rose-tinted belief that the 1980s was some kind of golden age of kids learning computers because computers were hard to use, so kids would go exploring how they worked. And that now, conversely, computers, laptops, tablets, mobile phones are just so easy to use and kids are shielded from the command line, so they don't do anything other than run programs by pressing a button. My memory of computing in the 80s was that we had to run games from the command line, but I and anybody I knew with a computer just learnt the right commands in the right order to make it happen. I had no idea what was happening under the covers when I did that, and it didn't really matter. I just knew it was necessary to make a game run. So basically, it was just harder work than it is now, but I had no better understanding or apparently any inclination to find out. I don't think the technology was the relevant part then or now. More important was the motivation of the children to explore, which could come from the child itself wanting to find out, or it could come from teachers and parents encouraging the child to learn. Hold on, I need to breathe. There are shortages of pupils wanting to study computing, but lack of technology is probably not the reason. After all, the sciences struggle too with getting children, students to do their A-levels and degrees. But toast still falls butter side down. Apples still hurt when they fall on your head, like in the 80s and indeed in the 1680s. And mayonnaise and paint are still the best known examples of household emulsions. Examples of science are everywhere and always have been. It's where the children ask questions about them that's the problem. I don't know what the answer is, but there's a lack of encouragement or inspiration from parents, teachers, TV, and the wider society. Maybe it's the lack of applicability of these subjects to real life. For instance, we could be teaching kids to program a simple app for their smartphone, for example, or the smartphone that they've just replaced and put in the drawer, for instance. They've got far more access to cheap technology now than ever before. So, yes, I think Raspberry Pi is a very cool bit of hardware, but I don't think it's the saviour of computing.
Thank you very much, Laura. You can
breathe again. I don't know why I didn't breathe.
That was quite impressive.
I fell into that trap last week.
I remember hearing,
Okay, right. So thank you for that. Mark, would you like to respond to that?
I would. I'm speaking as a survivor of the ICT education system that's been in place in the UK for the past 12 years. When I was in year 7, my secondary school replaced its Acorn Archimedes computers with Microsoft Windows PCs, and ICT lessons became an extended Microsoft Office training program. There was very little inspiration or opportunity for my fellow pupils and I to learn any real computer science until sixth form. At home, friends of mine weren't allowed to install games on the family computer due to parents who feared they might break them. Programming wasn't even on the cards. The Raspberry Pi has the potential to revolutionise the computer hardware landscape, both at home and in schools. Never before has a full-featured PC device been available at such a low price, a price that allows schools to kit out a computer lab for a fraction of what it would currently cost. At home, it's perhaps not pocket money, but certainly a birthday or Christmas present for kids. Coupled with the family TV and a cheap USB keyboard, it's a ready-to-go development environment with no worry of breaking the expensive family computer. Alongside the hardware, the Raspberry Pi is running a GNU Linux operating system. The current world of IT education is Microsoft-centric, is a Microsoft-centric environment with a smattering of Apple hardware in media subjects. The syllabus offers little opportunity for exposure to other systems, despite their wide implementation in the IT industry. Having a GNU Linux system running on the Raspberry Pi not only opens the eyes of its users to the existence of these systems, but to the open source ecosystem in general as well. Such exposure can then be fostered by the community in order to inspire the next generation of computer scientists. There's more to do to solve the problems with IT education, but the Raspberry Pi is the hardware to do it with.
Thank you, Mark. Short and sweet. Okay, so, Laura, you're saying that the Raspberry Pi is not all it's cracked up to be.
I'm saying it's very cool hardware, but they're marketing it as the answer to schools not teaching computing skills isn't fair.
Okay, so, Mark, why do you think this would work, but other things in the past haven't worked? This isn't the first embedded Linux board that we've seen.
No, but it's the first one which has hit the market and caused such a storm and made people, you know, it's got coverage on the BBC Evening News, where, you know, parents and kids are going to see it and say, well, maybe not kids watching the BBC Evening News, parents are going to see it and say, oh, what's this interesting looking device which I could buy for 30 quid for my kid and he can plug into the TV. I mean, I was talking about back in the day, as it was when I was at school, when, you know, the family computer was a 166 that cost £1,000, and, you know, your parents didn't want you to mess around with it because, if you know, they might need it for work or writing letters or whatever they did on it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, games consoles were for games and you couldn't do anything else with them other than play games, and the family computer was for a limited set of tasks.
But I had a 30-in-1 science kit, which allowed me to build simple circuits and make buzzers go off and doing simple things like that, which probably cost around the same as a Raspberry Pi, I guess, inflation adjusted. It was a Christmas present or a birthday present type of investment.
Exactly.
And yet, you know, I can bet I probably was maybe the only kid in my class who did have one of those. They were available, but, you know, people just weren't interested. Is it a case that, okay, there's a new tool, a new toy, a new gadget, but, you know, there isn't the interest from students in using that toy or gadget?
Sorry, Anne looks like he wants to say something.
No, I was just going to further push that question. I agree. I would like to see what argument there is that this has any place where a laptop that is already in the school and a copy of Python couldn't do.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose in my experience, having the... Well, if you have the laptop in the school, getting it then set up for development is a step too far in many cases in terms of what the IT support would tend to provide. I mean, bear in mind, in my computing class in sixth form, we had trouble getting a development environment set up on Windows for developing Visual Basic because of getting it set up on the network, whereas a Raspberry Pi is designed to be, you just plug it in and you can develop on it.
But this is why I say it's a people problem, because it's a school policy that, or, you know, if they want to provide support for teaching programming, they need to provide that policy. And until they do that, they're not going to be successful. And just buying more hardware for the IT department to support ultimately isn't going to help that, I'd have thought.
So who drives that change in policy? Is that down to parents pressuring the school to say, I've heard about this thing called a Raspberry Pi, it could be good, I think my kid might like it? Or is it the ICT person to start a pilot project? Or is it the headmaster lead from the top? How does the school start improving their ICT curriculum?
I think there is some limitations on what teachers can teach because of the syllabuses that they're allowed, and the especially when it comes to exams, what they're allowed to teach towards examination. I know a private school who's stepped out of that and said, okay, we're going to teach some programming, which has worked fairly well, I think. But that's quite a lot of effort to get to. And I think they still have network security issues, like policy stuff as well. So, I mean, some of it is going to have to be a top-down thing of, we want schools to be able to teach this stuff. And if the government wants schools teaching this kind of stuff, then they're going to have to encourage that to be on the syllabus or however syllabuses get written. But then, yeah, I mean, the teachers need to be willing as well. And, yeah, the parents need to be willing for the kids to want to do it, I think.
Mark, do you think the fact that it is just a circuit board and isn't in a case is an advantage?
Every computer is just a circuit board in a case.
No, the Raspberry Pi isn't in it.
Well, that, the current version is a development board. The one that actually goes out in the future will have a case.
Yes. Okay, right. Okay. So the one that is currently going out isn't in a case.
No.
No.
But no, I wouldn't have thought, if they were being pushed to schools as a circuit board, I wouldn't have thought that would be an advantage in particular, to be honest.
Does it not, if you were at school and there was a room full of computers running Microsoft Office and there's a room full of circuit boards, would you not, as a geek, you know, internally, yes, you're a geek, you'd be drawn towards something that looks geeky? It's got wires hanging out of it. You know, it's intrinsically more interesting because it's got wires hanging out of it and the stuff is bare bones.
I suppose so.
Than a computer that you've probably got one of at home or your parents have got, and so you've seen one of those 1,000 times.
Yes, no, okay. I suppose you're right from that point of view, but I don't think that, I mean, with a good-looking case, it is still a thing with a load of wires hanging off of it. So, and, you know, people, at the moment, people are attracted to shiny things, not spiky green things.
Yeah, but that's people as a whole. Everybody now has access to technology. Everybody's holding it constantly. They know about technology. And yes, it is shiny stuff. But the only difference between now and, say, the 1980s is that everybody's got access to that stuff. You've still got the minority of people who are self-motivated to go off and geek with it, and I'm sure that's not much different in terms of proportion. They were stuck for application to programmers in the 80s as well as now.
We've had some feedback in the IRC channel. Dogmatics has echoed your point, Laura, that would the teaching staff have the ability to implement Raspberry Pi effectively, but also asks, says that he would happily mention the Raspberry Pi to his son's school, but who would pick up the cost, the parents or the local education authority? Okay, it's 25 quid or however much it is, but that's 25 quid for one of them. Then there's a load of HDMI monitors, USB keyboards, power supplies, and okay, they're low-cost commodity items, but there's still, you know, possibly a lot of them you've got to buy. Who's going to pay for that stuff?
And you've still got the issue of, what are they going to teach on it? Somebody's got to sit down and write all this material of what they're going to teach. They've got to work out what children want to learn and are going to learn. I think there's aspects of the hardware and how computers work at hardware level. There's the software. There's how you apply it to real life, because I think that's part of it. Kids want to know how it applies to what they're used to. So, all right, writing an application for your smartphone probably isn't the easiest thing to start with, but at least it's got that kind of relevance. And I'm seeing grads come into grad recruits come into work now, and we're getting more and more interest in how are people going to use this. what's the point of it? Mm. And I think that's changed, possibly just because there's so much more technology around and people appreciating that it matters what you design.
Mm. Okay. Well, during the conversation, the members of the RC channel have been voting away on the motion. There's a sort of half vote in the mix, which might complicate. There's a half vote in the mix, which might complicate things. But generally, it seems that Laura has won.
Yay!
The prevailing opinion is that it's not the saviour of computer science, although there are some people who are saying it should have a great influence that will then become more clear further down the line. So well done, Laura. You have won the debate.
And it is called hardware, to be fair.
I can kind of see the difficulty. I mentioned that I was getting a Raspberry Pi to the ICT teacher at my kid's school, and he said, oh, great, I'd love to have a look at that sometime. Can you bring it in? And in the next breath, and said, I would like to pitch this as something we could do to make ICT more interesting. And then in the next breath said, I have no idea what open source is. Now, which you know, kind of made me wonder, do you really know why you're getting this? Or is it just because you've seen it on BBC News and there's been lots of fervor about it? You know, are we stirring people up and ultimately going to let them down?
And that's my worry about how they've released it hardware first, because there's no substance to it. It's hardware that's going to be released and people are going to go, okay, now how do I learn to program from it? And teachers especially, the fact is there aren't a lot of teachers who teach this stuff at the moment. Mm. And so what are they going to do with it?
I guess part of the idea is there's a development board now and you can put an SD card in it with Fedora or Debian or whatever and then develop that course material between now and, you know, the next education year, maybe between now and September.
Yeah.
Maybe people could get geared up and through the summer holidays, these lovely long holidays that the ICT teachers have, they could spend a bit of time playing with a Raspberry Pi, perhaps.
If you're an ICT teacher, email Alan at... Right, I'm sure that debate will run and run, but just not on this show.
And now it's time for some news. So, appropriately enough, Raspberry Pi, the $35 bare bones computer. It said $25 in Linux format.
One model is $25. The version that's just been released is $35.
Okay. Running Linux has gone on sale through two UK-based distributors. The first batch of units sold out in a matter of hours, while demand for the units brought down the websites of both distributors. Since the initial batch went on sale, the Raspberry Pi Foundation have announced a possible delay in the next batch of devices due to incorrect components being used.
Anyone ordered one?
No. I've asked for one for my birthday.
Aww.
Unsurprisingly, yes, I've ordered one.
Of course you have.
Yes.
You mean you haven't ordered three?
I did order two, and it got automatically switched back down to one during the order. So that was the rules, one per person.
Fair enough.
Yeah, be good to play with.
Well, let us know when you get it. We can bring it in and look at it. Apparently, we can't do anything with it.
Yes, it's Laura.
NVIDIA has joined the Linux Foundation, the non-profit organisation that funds Linux development. Along with AMD and Intel, all three major graphics chip designers are now members of the foundation.
Hooray! Can we have an open source NVIDIA driver, please, that does 3D and does colour profiles?
Do you know, I think this is more exciting. Well, for me personally, this is more exciting for their Tegra-based stuff rather than the desktop stuff.
Laptops.
Tablets. All the Asus Transformer has Tegra 2. The Transformer Prime is Tegra 3. If they can get, you know, better drivers for the Tegra, then that might benefit Android on tablets. It might benefit general Linux distributions on tablets and phones and stuff.
They haven't said that they're going to make anything open source that is not currently open source, presumably.
No, but it's still good that they're, you know, willing to start talking.
Step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so. The UK Cabinet Office has opened a public consultation on its proposed policy for the use of open standards in government. The document can be found online with forms for you to provide feedback on the proposals, link in the show notes.
I thought they already had a standard about open standards.
No, they had an open source thing that we talked about in the last series about procuring open source, but this is they've produced some sort of draft policies on implementation of open standards and what is an open standard.
Wake up, Tony, wake up.
Right, okay. I might have drifted off a little bit there.
It's all right. We'll discuss patents, won't we, Mark?
Oh,
and open source licenses.
Debate on that.
It does go into that as well.
Excellent. In the meantime, a GitHub user has exploited a well-known vulnerability of the Rails framework on which the site is built to gain admin rights over the Rails project repository. He could also have easily gained admin rights over all the other projects on GitHub. GitHub say they have now addressed the issue, but require all users to verify their SSH keys uploaded to their projects as an additional security measure. Rails have changed the framework's default configuration to prevent new systems from being vulnerable.
Yeah, there's a bit of a bum fight about this.
Yes.
Yes, this guy wasn't malicious. He just sent a funny message or stuck it somewhere.
Well, arguably, you know, it depends on which side of the fence whether you think it's malicious to have, you know, put a silly message up there and highlight the compromise when, you know, should he have done that more privately?
But then part of the argument was that there wasn't a well-defined private way of reporting these security things in GitHub.
But yes, the idea of including the Linux kernel, which is on GitHub, and several other major projects.
A lot of my code.
Well, that would be the first target to go for, wouldn't it? Yeah, go for the
Moodle
module. Cloud.
And that's all the news for now.
We have some events. OrgCon, the Open Rights Group Conference 2012, is in London on the 24th of March. And they've got Lawrence Lessig, who was in The West Wing.
No, he wasn't.
He was... Who was the actor?
It was the guy who played Doc Brown in Back to the Future, Christopher Lloyd, Lawrence Lessig in The West Wing.
I mean, that's going to be brilliant, being played in The West Wing.
To the FSFF.
okay.
Cory Doctorow and Wendy Seltzer, they're all going to be speaking. And you can find out more about that on their website. And there's also the Flossy Conference. I can't remember what it stands for, but it's Women in Open Source.
Yeah, it's a women-only conference, actually.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, totally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And that's the 25th of May, which is a Friday, and Saturday, 26th of May, at Queen Mary University of London. And they're currently taking proposals for talks and things until the 19th of March. And you can find out more on their website.
Cool. Is that all the events, Laura?
That is all the events.
Okay.
What about OrgCon?
Hello, and welcome to Tomorrow's Technology Today. I'm Douglas Austin Cambridge. Good day to all our listeners wherever you are around the British Empire. In today's look at Tomorrow's Technology Today, which we recorded yesterday, we'll be telling you about all sorts of technology you can expect tomorrow, or the day after that. I should also like to say good day to our charming hostess, Deirdre Morris Oxford. Good day, Deirdre.
Good day to you, Douglas.
Yes. So what splendicious item of tomorrow's technology have you for us today?
Following our piece on the world market for the electronic computer, it is estimated that the computers of the future may weigh no more than 1.5 tons.
Well now, Deirdre, a portable computer weighing only 1.5 tons, that's progress indeed.
Yes, Douglas. Although the stepped voltage transformer will require its own coal-fired power station to supply the electricity.
Ah, no, I have no idea what you're talking about, Deirdre.
Nothing new there, Douglas. And on the home front, it seems the domestic vacuum cleaning trolley will soon be a reality. So, ladies, dust in your carpets will soon be electrically sucked out of the house. Why do I always get the electrical domestic appliances? I'm a physicist, for heaven's sake.
Will you stick to the script, Deirdre?
Although this does rely on the construction of a national grid to supply electricity to every house in the country.
Every house, Deirdre? Including the poor? What on earth would they do with electricity? Probably squander it on reading socialist newspapers and childbirth, I'll wager.
Best not wager too much, Douglas. You've already lost your inheritance.
Well, that's all from Tomorrow's Technology.
Twice.
Well, that's all from Tomorrow's Technology today. Toodlepip and God Save the King. Look, I'm just having a bad run at the bookmakers lately.
Joined live from somewhere in California, the internet's Jono Bacon. Hello, Jono. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you guys?
Yeah, yeah, fine.
Yeah, pretty good. All the better for speaking to you.
Yeah. So I wanted to get you on to talk about something that you've been blogging and tweeting like mad about. You've been doing a bit of development work, which should scare a few people. What's all this about? Achievements?
It started a while back when I went to a gathering of community managers at PayPal once, and someone asked me the question, you know, how do we recognize contributions in Ubuntu? And it made me realize that day that we do it in a very ad hoc manner. We don't really have a way of identifying you've done this, you've done that, you've done this, without people putting together their own wiki pages. It got me thinking about the idea of some kind of achievement system, and then Ack, Stuart Langridge, was over visiting with his daughter, and I shared this idea of maybe we could do something with achievements with Ubuntu, and we sat down and started fleshing out how the system could work. And the basic idea of it is that it's a means of not only showing what you've done, but also a really discoverable way of finding things that you can do and learning how to do them as well. Because one of the biggest challenges we have in the community is people often know what they can do, but they don't know how to get started. So a big chunk of the system is delivering good documentation about how people can learn what to do.
Okay, so this started out in a conversation about how do we recognize the stuff people have done in the past, but right. You're thinking of this more how to motivate people to do things in the future and find out what they should be doing or what they could be doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think a big chunk of it is that everyone who joins our community, wherever they join, It's a bit of a journey. You know, they start because they're inspired by Ubuntu, and they feel this. They learn about how Ubuntu is put together by people all over the world, and they feel a sense of wanting to contribute. And then usually the next step is learning documentation, then trying to figure out something that you can do to help out, those kinds of different things. But I think that often people get pretty stuck in knowing what order they need to do things in. So as an example, you know, you may file a bug first, and then the next thing you might do is debug a particular bug, or you might try and fix the bug next. Like, there's typically a journey you can map out to it, and part of the system is being able to identify those different pieces in the journey, and then provide context-sensitive help that really helps people get started right away. So, you know, one of the things we often see in the community is, hey, you want to help out with this thing? Go and read this wiki page that's the size of the Magna Carta. And the idea is that it gets away from that. It's very specific help and guidance. And then, you know, when you accomplish something, you feel that sense of achievement when you see this little trophy appear that you can then show your friends and whatever else.
Okay, so there's been some negativity. I've been in some of the conversations and seen some of the reaction to this. And some of that is centered around... I don't really need to have a gold star to tell me I'm doing a good job. You know, it makes me feel like I'm back at kindergarten. But the way you're explaining it is more, it's not just about getting the star, it's the journey to get the star, the task you achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've heard some people who are suspicious of, you know, typically when people express their concerns about these kinds of systems, they're concerned about gamification. They don't want to see people contributing useless content in the with the sole goal of trying to get the little trophy icon. And I think a big chunk of this is about making sure we provide the right kind of accomplishments. The reason why I called it the system accomplishments as opposed to achievements is that this is about experiences. I mean, 500 posts to a bug report or 500 posts to a forum, to me, is not accomplishing anything necessarily, because a lot of people can game that. To me, this is about being able to file your first bug. The very first time you file a bug report, whether it's a good bug or a bad bug, you learn the skills that are necessary to contribute as a bug reporter. And I think that's really valuable. So I think it's about picking the right kind of accomplishments. And then secondly, identifying a way in which we can recognize accomplishments for the value that they bring as opposed to the traffic that they may bring.
So when you're talking about making them accomplishments and making sure there's something worthwhile, does that mean that there then has to be a manual step in the actual system itself in terms of working out whether the thing someone's done is valuable enough to warrant the accomplishment, or is it still all sort of automated?
So there's two types of accomplishments that the system currently supports. One we refer to as local, which is things such as I've sent my first email in Thunderbird, or I could do that one.
Yeah. Even Tony could do that one.
So, you know, those are things on your machine, and they're basically impossible to verify. There's no reason why someone couldn't conceivably fake those accomplishments by inventing the trophy file or something. Right. But in those situations, they're really only fooling themselves. I mean, you're pretty much at the bottom of life's ladder when you start doing that kind of stuff. And then on the other side of things, we've got what we call machine verifiable ones. And these are things that are really within the context of a community. So these are, for example, finding your first bug in Ubuntu. And that's all completely automated. Mm-hmm. So basically the way it works is the system is broken into a daemon and a GUI. And you can have multiple GUIs. So someone's like David Kaye has made a lens for this that fits into the dash. And then I've got a GUI that I include in the app. And basically what it does is it runs a set of scripts to just check the various accomplishments that are part of the system. So, for example, for filing a bug, it will talk to Launchpad and identify whether you filed a bug. And if you have, it will generate a trophy. And then it sends it to a service, which will then verify that you did actually that you did actually accomplish that particular trophy. And then it will sign it. It will GPG sign it, so you can't fake it. So the machine verifiable ones are completely automated and can't be faked.
What about some of these are going to be fairly tangible, like answered 100 questions on Ask Ubuntu. That's I'm sure there's an API that you could get that and, you know, right, filed a bug and curated a blueprint, and these kind of things are electronically or semi-automatically verifiable. What about the other things that we do in the community, which are not so easy or will probably require human intervention, like organizing a loco meeting or you know, maintaining wiki pages in a nice way, or
hosting a long running podcast.
Exactly. I mean, with the machine, the cool thing about the machine verifiable ones is that they can plug into any service. So it's not just specific to things like Launchpad. But like you say, there is a limitation in the fact that there's just some things you need a set of eyes on to be able to verify or to be able to identify. There's some things that we can't detect. For those, this is something I've not built yet, but this is relatively easy to build. And this is going to be what I refer to as kudos accomplishments. So this is, for example, an Ubuntu member or an Ubuntu core developer saying, I want to give you a kudos trophy for this particular work that you did. So as an example, Scott Kitterman, for example, a well-respected Ubuntu developer, may want to give a kudos award to Martin Pitt because he did a particularly good piece of work, or someone offers a lot of value at a loco meeting or something such as that. So for that, that's also relatively straightforward for us to implement. And the good thing about doing it in Ubuntu is that because we have different groupings of people, for example, Ubuntu members, or we have Ubuntu developers, Motus, loco members, we can assign different types of capabilities to different types of user as well.
Okay. So what's it all written in? How did you pull all this together? Is it it's got to be Python, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So the first thing to note is that I'm not a programmer. No. I'm a terrible programmer.
Yeah, we've seen Jakosha.
Exactly. And I'm a pretty bad programmer, but Python allows me to concoct the monstrosities that I've built in the past. And this is written using Python. It's The daemon part, the back end, is completely GUI independent. So if someone wants to write a Qt client or whatever else client, then they can. But I've written a GTK client that's included with it. The cool thing about the back end as well is that it operates over Dbus. So anything that can talk to Dbus, which is basically anything on a desktop in Linux, can take part, can use this system. It also means that the automated scripts can be written in any language, conceivably. Mm. Although I provide a Python library that acts as a convenience wrapper around Dbus, so it's nicer if you write in Python. Ubuntu One is an important part of it as well. This is something that Stuart and I debate. Well, we didn't really debate over it, but we never debate. We wanted to make sure that it was. You know, we didn't want to just use Ubuntu One just because it's Ubuntu One, but Ubuntu One really does solve a big chunk of the challenge because you got this third party validation service. You know, having these kinds of network services are really gnarly programming challenges, and Ubuntu One just provides all of that.
So does Ubuntu One just provide the sort of verification with the sort of central service, or will it sync your accomplishments between your machines through your own Ubuntu One account as well?
Yeah, so it syncs them as well. So basically what it is I've built this verification service, which is basically Ubuntu One running headless on a machine, mm-hmm. On a precise machine. And what happens is, in a nutshell, what it does is that when you take part in the system, when you use the accomplishment system and you want to take part in the machine verifiable ones, we ask you permission first because it's verifying it with the third-party service. Mm-hmm. What it does is it basically creates an Ubuntu One share. So all of your accomplishments go in there, and then that automatically syncs with the third-party service, which then verifies them and then puts them back in the share. So not only does this solve the networking component of making sure that these trophies are going backwards and forwards between the client and the server, but it also means that all of your trophies are synchronized across all of your Ubuntu machines, and that could include mobile phones and whatever else. Mm-hmm. And because there's a back end and a front end as well, and it's not tied to a particular GUI, it means that writing an Android client, for example, or writing a web client would be easy.
So what state is it in at the moment? Could I install it and start getting my achievements listed and stick a page on my website or on my wiki page or something and show my badges? Or where are we now?
So right now you can, it works. I mean, you can, it's still very much in development. So for example, to try it right now, there's no packages right now. That's where we're heading as the next step. But right now you can go to the wiki page, and the installation instruction is really easy. You basically check out a couple of bazaar branches and run something. It comes with a set of accomplishments already. There's not many because it's still early days. So there's about 14 or 15 accomplishments that are available right now for Ubuntu. It will detect if you've accomplished those particular things. It'll display them in the app. It pops up little notification bubbles when you've accomplished something or when you unlock things. A key piece of this is that, for example, some accomplishments you need to achieve something else first before it makes sense for them to be unlocked. So, as an example, you wouldn't want to provide the file above accomplishment until you've achieved the registered account and launchpad accomplishment. As an example, so because you need a launchpad account to file a bug. So. Hmm. But it's basically all working. The next step is, like I say, I want to put together some packages. But before I do that, I need to make the back end component work as a proper daemon, so it can be started and stopped as a system service. Right now, you have to run the daemon manually. I mean, it's a single command, but obviously, when you've got a package, you want it to just be automated. So
are you going to be able to release this under an open source license? Will other projects be able to adopt this framework for their own achievements or accomplishments?
Yeah, so it's pretty open in the sense that, I mean, you can, even though I've obviously built it around Ubuntu, so for example, it uses Ubuntu One and it uses, you know, it pops up, you know, notify OSD bubbles and things such as that, and the accomplishments that are included are well, that I've been working on are Ubuntu-related accomplishments. There's no reason why you couldn't have accomplishments for Thunderbird or GNOME or KDE or whatever else. It's essentially an open standard in the way that these accomplishments can be put together. The only particularly Ubuntu-specific component is the fact that it uses Ubuntu One. But Ubuntu One's not specific to Ubuntu in itself, so there's no reason why you couldn't use
achievements.
Yeah.
All those other implementations of Ubuntu One out there.
So are you looking for help from the community? What do you need?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so it's been pretty cool recently because one of the most important pieces in my mind about this, like I said earlier on, is the fact that when you display the available accomplishments that you haven't got yet, it gives you documentation for how those accomplishments work. So, for example, it describes what it is. It shows an icon. It tells you whether it's locked or not. It provides a set of steps to tell you how to accomplish that thing. It provides tips and tricks and pitfalls. And I think a really important piece here is going to be making it easy for our documentation writers in our community to be able to provide really good documentation there that's also translated. So a couple of weeks ago, I started building. I'd never used Django before, but I started building a Django web app to make it easy to edit these accomplishments that are part of the system. And a small team has formed around that now that's building out that application, that web app. So if people are interested in Django or web programming, that's a great place to help. If people are interested in documentation and testing, definitely interested in that as well. There's something that anybody. If anyone's interested, there's something we can find you to do.
Excellent. And, so we just give everyone your email address and...
Yeah.
Have you got a wiki page or where is it all centered around?
So the wiki is wiki.ubuntu.com/accomplishments with a capital A. You can find out all the details there. It tells you how to install it, how to contribute accomplishments, how to participate in the project. Or if anyone gets stuck or is interested, then drop me an email to jono@ubuntu.com.
Awesome.
Brilliant.
Well, good luck, and I hope to see this as a package that we can install and things, little web things we can have on our websites and show off our little badges. That's cool.
Absolutely.
Yes. Indeed. Well, thank you for talking to us.
Thanks.
Cheers, Jono.
Bye.
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 And now it's time for the bit about Ubuntu, and the Canonical design team have set up a poll about multi-monitor support on the popular blog OMG Ubuntu.
Yes, they have.
The popular blog.
Yes. And it asks you some fairly simple questions. There's just like two questions about, do you use multi-monitor or not, and how do you use it, that kind of stuff.
And it's to do with the Unity location as well, isn't it?
Or the launcher bar, yeah. Because... This is somewhat problematic. Is the whole how does the launcher behave when you've got two monitors, and do you have the launcher on the primary or the secondary monitor, the main one or the second one? Do you have the monitors side by side? Do you have one above the other? Do you have mirrored monitors, or do you have a launcher on both? And how do you manage the transition from one screen to another? And it's all pretty complicated, and it's not an easy thing to solve. Although Windows has had it working fairly well since...
Yeah, quite a long time. In fact, I think even before that, I think in 98 it was still...
But then on good. Windows, you can move the taskbar to whichever side you want.
Yeah, so we're working with the premise that the launcher stays on the left. Mm. And if you've got a monitor...
Two side by side,
and your main one is the one in front of you, you want the launcher on that one, and the other monitor is to your left, then you have to traverse
the launcher.
Yeah. So they've tried various things, like slowing the mouse down as you travel across the launcher so that you can more easily hit the launcher, because it's between the two monitors in effect.
Right. So you might overshoot it.
Yeah, because you might overshoot it. So it actually slows the barrier then, the mouse down. But the problem with that is as you drag a window from one screen to the other, you slow down as you go past. And
that's quite annoying.
Yeah, so that's why they're trying to figure out how people use multi-monitors, so they can figure out the best policy for how to set this up. And
it's a good way of doing it.
It's not easy.
There's been a lot of people participating anyway, so hopefully it will come up with a useful outcome.
Yes.
There's a user survey as well, is that right?
Yes, there's also a user survey, which was...
Let's interview Alan.
Which was set up, I think, by Jerry Carr at Canonical. And this was... It's more of a high-level, you know, but asks questions about how would you use Ubuntu? How did you come across Ubuntu? Do you use it work or home? Do you use a tablet? You know, the kind of, you know, demographic-style questions to find out what our user base is like.
And it's interesting to see that it's just a SurveyMonkey survey, but there are both English and Spanish versions.
Yeah, because, you know, otherwise we're selecting our, you know, audience based on the primary language.
Yeah.
That's a little bit unfair.
But then also, and I understand it would be a lot of work, English and Spanish are two of the most popular languages in the world.
So I hear, yes.
But yeah, there are also a lot of other languages that...
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in the future, maybe we'll fully translate all of the surveys and then collate all the data. But this is a step in the right direction to go to at least... I think actually there's more than two. I think there's actually a third language they've added as well.
Mandarin.
yeah, that'd be good.
Oh, Portuguese.
Oh.
Sorry.
There you go.
Portuguese, oh, Brazil.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, indeed. Cool. Okay. Well, we'll put the links in the show notes. So if you want to take part in that survey, you can get along and find out. The cat attack has resumed. He's now chewing your PSU.
So I just not plugged in.
Let's talk about privacy.
No cats are harmed in the making of this podcast.
So 12 of our ships with new privacy controls that were developed by Zeitgeist developers and community members Manish and Stefano.
Yeah.
And Safe.
Yes. So this was mentioned on a couple of blogs. I think the EFF even had an article about 12 of 4 will bring OS level privacy options.
Yeah.
And
what's this mean?
So Zeitgeist is this demon thing that tries to figure out what you've been doing. And the ultimate goal, we interviewed Safe probably about 18 months ago. The ultimate goal is to do things like recognize when you were playing a certain song and editing a document at the same time. You know, if you did a search for the song, you'd see the song and the document together, that kind of thing, to make contextual search more clever than just, you know, searching for the file name or rummaging in a folder for a file, that kind of stuff. So it's more clever search. But the problem is it has to, in order to be able to figure those results out, it has to have some data about what you've been doing.
Yeah,
kind of profiling. And some people don't like the idea that the computer tracks what they're doing.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a whole number of embarrassing scenarios that spring to mind quite readily.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you plug your screen into a monitor and then give a demo and you press the button and search for something inappropriate might come up for the audience that you're targeting. So, you know, one of the features that the Zeitgeist guys with the community have come up with is some controls to make it forget some of that data if you want to. And that's been implemented in 12.04, which is good.
It's certainly great to see community developers having such a big role in a major feature. I mean, the privacy controls have been all over the blogs talking about the alpha release.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
So the Canonical design team worked with them as well, which is really cool.
Yeah, this feature was developed like a year ago or something, and it was just a set of radio buttons and tick boxes, you know, to enable and disable various bits. And the design team helped them fine-tune the look and feel of... what it should look like. So that's good.
Cool. Okay. There's also been a blog post about quality, the QA team, the quality assurance team.
Yeah, this is one of Jono's guys has written a blog post. I'll put a link in the show notes. It just summarizes the whole QA in Ubuntu, which, you know, is a meme that Mark's been going on about 12.04, that the 12.04 release is supposed to be all about quality.
Is that the LTS?
Yeah.
Surely the next release should be all about quality.
The next one.
Yes, because
it's a queue, because it starts with a Q. Yeah. Well, we'd like the LTS to be quality as well. Let's do both. Let's have both being quality. I mean, it's a radical thought.
Let's fix books for 12 months.
So QA is not one of those sort of glamorous, sexy things to work on.
It's not, but you'd be amazed how many people work on QA for Ubuntu.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily need to have your developer background to do QA. You can be
not at all
a non-technical person and do a really good job of it.
And if you are a QA person and you're interested in this kind of role, I think we're hiring.
Oh really?
Yeah.
/ get involved.
yeah, not the podcast. Canonical.
Yes. QA is testing, isn't it?
No.
What's QA then?
I can't tell you in this amount of time.
It's about saying whether the testing's any good.
Look at the blog post. It gives you more detail.
Okay. Yeah.
It tells you what all of the teams do, all the QA teams. Okay.
And finally,
not about Ubuntu this week, the OpenStreetMap project has drawn attention to the new iPhoto app from Apple, which appears to be using OSM's data for its mapping feature. However, it's currently lacking attribution of the data to the project's contributors.
Yeah, and they're using an old map generation, yeah,
2010
aren't they?
Data.
Yes.
Apparently.
Interesting, though.
But yeah, someone's written a little web app which overlays the iPhoto map and the OpenStreetMap data. And so you can see all of the borders match up absolutely pixel perfect in both sets. It's quite interesting. You can change the transparency level of each one, so fade them in and out.
Yeah, it's quite good fun. I did look at and I did notice that my road has actually been is different between the old map data and the current OpenStreetMap.
Does it now have a pin for your house?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Popey was here. Blue black.
Hey, I'm not dead.
Not yet. Just haven't stopped moving. Right, that's all in the bit about Ubuntu and not about Ubuntu this week. Just a couple of pieces of feedback to talk about this time. And Shane, an Aussie living in Japan, good luck with his accent, Laura, has emailed in to say,
Unity, I tried to like it. I tried to just ignore it, but I couldn't. So then I installed CairoDoc and hello world. CairoDoc turns your Unity desktop back into something usable and sexy again. Everyone should join the Unity ride because I think the destination is the right one, but the vehicle is wrong. So just hitchhike on CairoDoc as your form of transport, set Unity to hide, and you'll probably never even have to open it ever again. Why don't you guys just give CairoDoc more exposure? It's 100% the answer to Unity. 100%.
He quite likes CairoDoc, doesn't he?
And you... mixed metaphors.
Yes.
But you did actually try it, didn't you, Laura?
I did, and it is very shiny and sexy. It's basically the thing that Apple have at the bottom of their screen.
Right, the dock.
Yeah, where you hover over it and it goes. And in fact, if you hover over...
You were going to give a sound effect then, weren't you?
Yeah. Aww. If you hover over the Ubuntu logo in the bottom left, which if you click it, it opens the standard applications menu. If you hover over it for long enough, little fireworks fire up into the sky.
Right. Yeah, we need that.
Good.
Yeah.
It's quite cool.
Meanwhile, back on planet Earth, yeah. Alex Wilms emailed to say...
The Document Foundation applied for the Google Summer of Code 2012, and they are looking for students who want to hack on the project. There are many interesting ideas that... Sorry. There are many interesting ideas that could be achieved on their wiki. If somebody wants to get involved, he or she will need to apply until April the 6th and complete an easy hack.
Cool.
Yes. And we'll have a link in the show notes.
Yeah, so if you're interested in that, find out more on their wiki, on their website. And if you've got any feedback to send in, you can find out how after this little bit of music.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook and IRC channels. Let us know what you think of the show or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us on Tuesday the 27th of March for our next live episode.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I've got your cat hair all over my laptop now.
That could be a lot worse.
And possibly malfunctioning headphones next to it chewing the cable.
Yeah, send us a bill. Right, so we'll see you all in a couple of weeks. Are we all going to be here?
Yep.
Yes.
Hopefully I'll be a bit more practiced than this time.
Well, we all will. It's your first episode back. You're
it
allowed.
It was.
Anyway, excuses. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.